The Second World War, a podcast by Stephen Bedard.
Welcome to the Second World War podcast. This is Stephen Bedard. My original plan for this episode was to look at the German invasion of Denmark and Norway, but instead we have a special treat. I had the opportunity to interview author Claire Mulley, and she has written a couple of books that I think that you will find extremely interesting. I had a really enjoyable conversation with her, and I think that you're going to enjoy it as well. So please have a listen. In this episode of the podcast, we have Claire Mulley, and Claire is an award-winning author and broadcaster. She is the author of The Woman Who Saved the Children, The Spy Who Loved, and The Women Who Flew for Hitler. A popular public speaker, she has given a TED talk at Stormont, spoken at the Houses of Parliament, Royal Albert Hall, Imperial War Museum, National Army Museum, and the British Library, as well as many festivals. Thank you, Claire, for being on the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
The first thing I was curious about is, did you always know that you wanted to be a writer?
Well, yes. When I was little, I really wanted to be a writer, but I really was no good at dreaming up plots and I was terrible at dialogue. So I just thought this is never going to happen. And it took till I was working at an international charity, actually, Save the Children, that I came across the story of the founder of Save the Children. And I started piecing it together and I just thought, this is fantastic. And I realized rather belatedly that I could write books that I didn't have to invent a plot for because they already exist in history. And now, although I do love reading novels as well, I really love nonfiction. I find it much more fascinating if the stories you read have that grounding of truth. And I feel you can learn so much more from them. So yes, now I'm completely addicted to nonfiction and I love writing biographies and histories like that.
I love reading history. History has been a big part of my background as well. And I love to hear these stories. And oftentimes there are stories in history that in some ways seem more unbelievable than a lot of the fiction that is out there. Now, the particular aspect of history that you focused on for at least two of your books is that of the Second World War. And I was curious how that became an interest.
Well, all three of my books are actually about women responding to war in very different ways. And my first book, The Woman Who Saved the Children, is about the woman who founded that charity as a response to what she saw just before in the build-up to the First World War. And it's a remarkable story. She's not the sort of woman, you know, I thought she'd be some sort of quite dull saint, but actually I loved her. She hated children. She got arrested. She was absolutely fantastic, a real rule breaker. So I love that story. But the only thing that frustrated me was that I couldn't interview anyone who had known her. Everyone had passed on. And so I thought when that book came out and did surprisingly well, or I thought surprisingly well, that it would be really good to move forward a war and interview some of the veterans, some of the witnesses, perhaps they didn't serve, perhaps they were children in the war and so on, but capture some of those stories before they're lost. And so I started looking at the Second World War. So that's why I've moved to the Second World War. And I'm very interested in women's stories because, well, you know, you were saying that some stories in, you wouldn't believe them. These are the women's stories that I tell are stories that people go, really? You know, if it was a novel, you just think they've gone too far. She's made it up. It's absolutely ridiculous. So sometimes women seem to have fallen off the radar. There is this rich seam of untold women's stories that sometimes seem quite unbelievable. And that's what I thought with both of my subjects in my Second World War books, The Spy Who Loved, about Britain's first female special agent, who's just sort of been dropped from history, it seems, and The Women Who Flew for Hitler, which is another extraordinary story.
Yeah, when I saw that The Spy Who Loved had been optioned by Universal Studios, I thought that definitely could be a movie. That sounds like something that people would encounter for the first time in the movie, even if it was fictional. It sounds like a good fictional story, and yet it was truth.
Yes, and for me, it has so much more weight and resonance because it was true. And you have to, you can really imagine this woman went through this and put yourself in her shoes. So, although, I mean, I tried to do that, but I certainly don't have the courage that Christina had and the, although I think that all too often stories of women in the resistance or female special agents, they tend to focus on the courage, and her courage was absolutely undeniable. What's fantastic about her story is that she wasn't just brave and you know, she was quite beautiful, but it's not just about a beautiful, brave woman. This is a woman who achieved so much. And so it's a story that talks about all the accomplishments and the real impact she had on the course of the Second World War.
What I love about, especially the two books about the Second World War, and that this focus for all of your books on strong women, is it really challenges a lot of the assumptions that people have about women's role during the war. Probably for many people, they think of women maybe as secretaries in war offices, yes, or perhaps even working in the factories to provide opportunities for the men to go off to war. And yet there were some that were on both sides that were very active. In fact, I think the first time that I encountered something like this, and perhaps you've looked at this as well, is I've heard, there's some books about some of the Soviet snipers who were women. That was a role that they had.
Yeah, the snipers and the pilots and so on. Mm-hmm. And there are, I mean, you're absolutely right. When people tend to think of the woman's war, they think of Rosie the Riveter putting together a Spitfire, or they think of the women at Bletchley Park, certainly in Britain. So they're all women on the home front or working at home. But of course, in fact, Britain did send out women in all sorts of roles. We had female pilots who were delivering the planes from the factories to the airfield, sometimes under fire. We had female special agents who were armed and trained and served alongside the men behind enemy lines in the field in occupied nations. And of course, those countries on the European continent, there wasn't a home front that was different. The home front was the war zone. So if you look at the women in Poland, you have many female soldiers who were serving in the street battles in their hometowns and cities. So there wasn't that distinction. And of course, with the Soviets, you get women who served as snipers, as you say, as pilots on the front line, both bombers and fighter pilots. You had female tank drivers, you had female infantry soldiers, all professionally recruited, going through the same system as the men. So you actually have women in all the different roles in the Second World War, but it's not really talked about.
It's sad that it's not, as it is so important. The truth is, a balanced look is that there were both men and women behind the scenes and men and women on the front, and that's right. What we need to have, and not this one-sided view. Now, I was curious where how you came across each of these figures, because I had never heard of any of them until I had encountered you and the books that you had written. Where did you find them?
Well, for the Second World War stories, as I said, I was looking to write about a woman in the Second World War, and I had an interest in Polish history anyhow. I'd studied part of Polish politics as part of my first degree, and it's such a fascinating country because it's right in the heart of Europe, and it faced war on two fronts very early on, because obviously the Nazi invasion of Poland is what set off the Second World War, but within 3 weeks they were invaded from the east by the Soviets as well. So it becomes a very fascinating country to look at in the war. So I was thinking about that, and that my agent actually suggested Christina Skarbek, and I hadn't heard of her either, to my shame. But I immediately said no, because I felt like he was sending me off on a blind date. And, you know, I really wanted to find my own book subject. Thank you very much. So I said no, but just to be polite, I thought I'd look into her a little bit. And immediately I was seduced by her, like just about everyone she came in contact with. She was such a remarkable character, and her achievements were so great that I realised it was almost insulting that this story hadn't been told. So I set off on her. And then I decided... But my publishers actually wanted me to do a set of books on some of the other female special agents, but I felt that I wanted to be doing something new for my own learning. And also, it might become a bit of a competition between these women, and that's not how it was, you know. So I thought I'd look at the women on the other side of the war. And I had heard of Hannah Reich, which some of your listeners may have heard of this remarkable woman as well. She was the first woman to fly a helicopter in the world. She ended up test flying all sorts of things, like a massive glider called a Gigant that was large enough to take 200 armed men or even a tank into action. And she ended up flying the the rocket plane, the Comet, the 163. And finally, she even flew what we call the V1, or the British call the buzz bomb or doodle bug, which is basically a prototype cruise missile. So she was one of that very rare group of people that flew a V1. So she's quite well known. But I had absolutely no idea that she wasn't the only female test pilot in Nazi Germany. There were two, and the other one was probably even more valuable to the Nazi regime. And her name was Melita Schiller, or Melita von Stauffenberg, as she became when she married, which may ring a few bells with some of your listeners. And her story is even more remarkable than that of Hannah. These two women knew each other. They often served from the same airfields. They were the only two members of the Berlin Air Club, apart from, you know, some secretaries or wives. They were the only two that were women that were there under their own right. And they knew each other, but they absolutely loathed one another. And when I came across Melita's story, which is absolutely extraordinary, I knew, you know, the hairs started going up my arms. I knew I had to write this book.
In terms of their relationship with each other, was Hannah aware that Melita was part Jewish?
Yes, she was indeed. And she was known, we have some accounts of her screaming insults on towards her on that basis, what she thought was insults, certainly. And in fact, at one point, she knows that she's Jewish, and she holds that against her. I mean, Hannah wanted to be the queen of the Nazi female flying world. She didn't want to have another rival in there. And the fact that this other woman was possibly more talented, because Hannah was a test pilot, Melita was a test pilot as well, but she was also an aeronautical engineer, and she had worked on the development of the Stuka dive bomber, which is the aircraft that is synonymous with the Blitzkrieg, but the one that came screaming down, sometimes at sort of 80 degrees, near vertical, whistling on its back wheel, so that siren sound coming in and terrifying people on the ground below. And so she developed the dive sights and the dive brakes for the Stuka dive bomber. So she was an absolutely extraordinary aeronautical engineer, but she insisted on doing her own test work as well. And the reason was that because she was Jewish and the Nazi state knew that her father had been born Jewish. She'd actually been brought up not in the Jewish faith at all, and it goes down the female line. However, she would certainly have been considered Jewish by the Nazis. So she eventually applied for something called equal to Aryan status, which was only given to very few, about 300 people. And when she was eventually offered it, because the Nazis needed her skills, they needed her, she was irreplaceable, nobody could do the work she was doing, she actually refused it unless that status was given to her family. And if people read the book, they'll find out that that wasn't enough for her in the end. And she actually became very involved in the internal German Widerstand, or the internal German resistance against Hitler himself later on in the war. But so it was known that she was given this equal to Aryan status, and Hannah knew that she had some Jewish ancestry, and she absolutely loathed that about her. Not only was she being usurped as her role as the Nazi test pilot, but it was by a woman that she thought was, unfortunately, from her perspective, she had this horrendous anti-Semitism.
And Hannah was more than just a patriotic German. She was very devout in terms of her faith in Nazism as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I was very lucky. I managed to interview quite a few pilots from the Luftwaffe, well, a couple of pilots from the Luftwaffe, but also other people on the other side of the war, including some relatives and so on. And one of the people I interviewed was a British test pilot, very famous over here, known as Eric or Winkle Brown. And he knew Hannah before the war. He'd seen her flying helicopters at the Berlin Motor Show in 1938, and at the Olympics in 1936. He'd seen her in a gliding demonstration. So he knew her before the war. They'd become good friends at a party at Goering's flat, actually. Goering's, well, not really flat, his very nice apartment in Berlin. Then he, at the end of the war, he managed to track her down. He actually handed her over to the Americans for interrogation. And yet they stayed in touch, and they knew each other in the international flying circuit after the war as well. And he described very clearly to me how she was an absolutely fanatical Nazi. And when I dug into the archives in America as well, we have her post-war debriefs and interrogation reports, and it's clear that she is absolutely that. I mean, she does criticise Hitler, but not for his moral or policy positions. She criticised him for not winning the war. That's her only complaint. Wow. And in fact, the last interview that was recorded with her, I think it was an American, might have been a Canadian journalist, and he said, this was in the 70s, late 70s, and he said, Hannah, you've, since the war, she'd become a bit of an ambassador for youth leaders. She was very well known in the media in Germany, very well known figure. And he said, you've gone on the record a lot. She published her memoirs and so on. But you've never addressed your feelings about the war and the fact that you were a supporter of the Nazi Party. And he said, I'd like you to give me this opportunity. Do you have any regrets? Do you feel any guilt? And she said, yes, I do. I feel guilty about the war. I feel guilty that we lost. So that was in 1978, 1979. So right, and that was the year she died. Right until the end of her life, she still had those convictions, and she still wore the little pin badges that she'd received with a swastika on them, even when they were illegal in Germany.
That's amazing. So I can't imagine someone with those beliefs in competition with someone with Jewish blood, and the tension that must have been there. That is absolutely incredible. Now, that really testifies to how much the Germans needed Melita, that they were willing to work with her, considering her Jewish heritage. And then they continued to use her even after her brother-in-laws were convicted.
Yes.
In part of the plot to assassinate Hitler, which amazed me. I would have thought that would have been the end of it, and yet they continued to use her.
Absolutely. I know. I mean, I couldn't believe her story. So here she is. Her father was born Jewish, had converted. Then she discovers that she only finds that out roughly when the Nuremberg laws come in. So that's extraordinary enough. Then she develops, you know, she's the lead engineer on the Stuka dive bomber. She is given her own aeronautical institute. She reports directly to Goering. I mean, she is absolutely at the top of her work in Nazi Germany. And of course, flight was an incredibly macho field wherever you were in Europe, but no more so than in Nazi Germany. So that's extraordinary on its own. But then beyond that, she comes around, as she begins to understand, or she begins to see what is happening, then she realizes that she cannot stand by and let this happen in her name. And she becomes very involved in probably the most famous assassination attempt on Hitler, which is the Valkyrie bomb plot led by her brother-in-law, Klaus von Stauffenberg, on the 20th of July, 1944. And I think the most extraordinary thing I found during my research was her handwritten diary from 1943 and 1944. And there's a picture of one of the pages in the book. I'm not sure if it's the 20th of July, but obviously I did quickly turn to that page. I read the whole thing with some help, actually, because it's semi-coded. You just see in her writing that in the days, well, in the weeks running up to that plot, she's meeting with Klaus and Berthold, his brother, more and more often. What she's doing is she's, because she's a pilot, she's allowed to take a yacht out on the Wannsee, the lake inside Berlin, as part of her rest and recuperation. And so she meets them and she takes them out on the lake. The reason she's doing this is, you know, partly to have a nice time, but mainly because nobody can overhear you if you're on a boat on the middle of a lake. It's one of the safest places for them to be discussing their plans. And this is the month, and increasingly happening in the weeks before the plot. And then on the days before the plot, the night before Klaus leaves, she is staying overnight at his Tristan Strasser flat. And there is no way she didn't know what was going on. And later I came across an interview with a man who said he had known her in the war, and she had told him that Klaus had asked her to fly him to the Wolf's Lair to put the bomb down. As it turned out, she couldn't get the right plane on the right day. So they went with his Luftwaffe adjutant. They had a plan B. But she was right at the heart of that plot. And so, of course, I thought, well, that's going to be where it ends, because we know that what happened to Klaus, he was shot that evening. His brother Berthold, who was involved in the plot, he was hanged in appalling circumstances not long later. And she herself was arrested and sent to prison. So I thought that would be the end of it. but not at all. She manages to talk her way out. She's got all these high-level contacts. She pretends she knew nothing about it. And because they need her, they need her skills. No one can do. By that point, she's working on blind flying and night landing systems. And they absolutely need her work. So they release her, and she goes back to the airfield after 6 weeks in prison. The day they release her, she goes back to work. She'd actually done some work in the prison. But she doesn't continue her work for the Nazis. She turns up there, but immediately she diverts. And then she has this other sort of second role at the end of the war, which is truly remarkable as well. But I don't want to give it all away.
No, of course. We want people to buy the book.
Well, that would be nice.
Yeah, it actually sounds like this would be a great movie as well. The tale of both of these women, that they have in some ways so much in common, and yet they diverge in such radical ways. I think this would make a fantastic movie. So hopefully someone jumps on that.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. Any movie people, TV people, do get in touch.
That's right. Yes, we need to push this. These are great things. And I'm so glad that you are writing these stories, and not that they're just stories, but writing these biographies, sharing what has happened, and bringing forward a narrative that a lot of people aren't familiar with. Now, I don't know much about this, and so you can correct me, but it sounds to me, in the way the Germans were in including these women, that they may have been a bit more progressive than the Allies, outside of the Soviets. I guess the Soviets probably were a bit more. But were there roles like this among the British and the Americans?
Okay, I think we have to sort of stop there. I don't think we can use the word progressive with the Nazis very effectively, really. Melita and Hannah were two absolute exceptions. They did have a couple of other women only at the very end of the war who worked delivering planes, a bit like, you know, ferry pilots. So they did have a couple of those towards the end of the war, but that was it. And these were the only two women that were serving as test pilots. So no other women were undertaking roles like that in Nazi Germany. So okay. There's exceptions.
That makes sense.
But yes, I mean, some of the other allies did have women working fantastic roles, not always officially. So obviously the Soviet Union is quite an exceptional case. But there are other communist countries like Yugoslavia and so on, as was, who also have women soldiers recruited into their forces, into their armed forces, you know, trained and armed and serving alongside the men. So you have that. But then you have other countries as well. For example, in Poland, you have women who are from the very start serving in the armed forces. You have the women, very famously, at the end of the Warsaw Uprising in 1944, which the Warsaw Uprising started in August 1944 and went on till October. They were hoping to be supported by British planes dropping supplies, arms and so on. And that was attempted. And certainly a lot of the Polish the Polish pilots who were based in Britain very bravely, with huge losses, went out to drop supplies to them. But the Soviets wouldn't let them land to refuel, wouldn't give them any support in their air paths. And the Soviet army arrived at one side of the river on the outskirts of Warsaw and stopped and waited for the Nazis to decimate the resistance so that then they could come in more easily. So they were pretty much on their own. But what you had is men, women and even some children serving in the Warsaw Uprising. And eventually, after some terrible losses, but a massive sort of incredible 63 days of defensive fighting, they were forced to capitulate. And the Germans accepted the female soldiers as prisoners of war and took them off to a prisoner of war camp as soldiers. That's something that hadn't happened anywhere else in the war. So the female soldiers of Poland are really worth some research and interest there. And of course, you have British women serving as special agents. And they are trained, they are armed, and they are sent into enemy-occupied nations to serve in. Originally, they were sent specifically as wireless operators and couriers, but a lot of them stepped up and they served as circuit leaders, leading armies into battle and so on, leading sabotage operations, the exact same work the men were sent out for. And those women weren't just British women. So in the British SOE, there were women from at least 13 different countries. That included Poland, it included Germany, Jewish German women who then went back in. It included some Americans. There was a wonderful woman called Virginia Hall who only had one leg. She had a prosthetic leg. She served in France for an awful long time as one of the most successful female agents. So you have all of these different nationalities, all women, going to serve. And the reason why they were so effective is because, you know, a lot of people tend to think it's because they were so beautiful, they were honey traps, they seduced the enemy. Well, no. The thing that women had is that they were naturally, well, not naturally, but they were overlooked. They were dismissed. So they could travel around the world, especially after things like the service travail obligé came in France, where the Germans took any able-bodied men back to Germany. Well, they're either in prisoners of war, or they were sent back into factories to do the German, to work for the German war effort. So young men or service-aged men moving around the country were very suspicious. But women were all moving around the country. They were trying to keep businesses going. They were looking after their families and so on. So women could travel around without being stopped and searched as much as any man would have been. So they could take arms and ammunition. They could courier information and intelligence around and so on. So that's why the women played such an important role.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Now, Claire, in your time as a researcher and an author, what would you describe as your highlight so far?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's just been a complete joy from start to finish. I'm quite slow. I do love throwing myself into the research. And I think perhaps the best things are those moments, like I said, when I found the handwritten diary of Melita von Stauffenberg explaining her connection to the bomb plot. And that was something that wasn't in any of the military archives. I mean, many of the men, obviously I look at the men's stories as well, because these people are working together and their papers are in either the Deutsche Museum archive or in the military archives in Germany. But the women's papers seem to have been sent back to their families. One of them was marked domestic and sent back. It just wasn't a consideration that this could have relevance for the war history of the countries. And so to discover documents like that really makes, you know, really is very exciting. But also interviewing individuals as well. So I was very lucky that I managed to trace Klaus von Stauffenberg's eldest son, Berthold von Stauffenberg. And I mean, he's given a few interviews. You can find him on a couple of radio shows and so on. And he said to me that he's actually spoken enough about his father. He didn't really want to meet about that. And I said, I'm really sorry. It's not your father, really, I want to talk about. It's your aunt, Melita. And he said, why don't you come to Germany? Nobody's ever asked me about my aunt before. And he remembered her really vividly from when he was a young boy in the war. And so, yeah, so just extraordinary. I went out, met him at his place, and we spent most of the day discussing it. And at one point, he kind of clicked his heels together and kissed my hand very genteelly as I was going to leave. And then he said, you know, you should be careful doing that. And I was like, oh, what? And he said, you know, this hand is only one handshake away from Hitler. Mm. Because, of course, he had held his father's hand and his father had shook Hitler's hand just days before he attempted to assassinate him. And so moments like that, you know, you really feel like you're shaking hands across history, that you're almost touching that moment. And that really is extraordinary to bring that back to life.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that would be a highlight for sure. Now, if you were to give, this is a two-part question. If you were to give advice to people who are interested in becoming a writer, that's part one. And then part two would be writing specifically in the area of biography or history. What kind of advice would you want to share?
Well, do it, definitely. There's lots of stories that need telling. I think for me, some of the most important things is one has been just reading perhaps outside of my comfort zone. So I'm constantly got, well, it's very dangerous. I have these tottering piles of books everywhere. So reading always inspires me to get back in there. Read the sort of stories that you want to write, but also read the other stuff as well. And the other thing is, I suppose for me doing my research, which I absolutely love, is without being rude, being determined. So, I mean, obviously there are times where I've wanted to interview family members and so on, and they haven't wanted to meet or to share that information. And I understand that and I respect it. but it's the idea of always following up every lead, sending out your letters, sending out your emails, trying to think of creative ways around things, because you never know what you don't know. And even a very small lead, in my mind, I consider it, this is ridiculous, but I always imagine they're homing pigeons. So I fire off all these emails, or I send the letters, and I ask everyone I meet. And you never know where something's going to lead. The original story that you think you're going to write quite often morphs into something very different and perhaps, you know, slightly less heard of, a less known idea. So follow everything up.
Well, thank you so much, Claire, for sharing in this podcast and telling a bit of your story. And I think that our listeners will be encouraged to dig deeper into the stories that need to be told. And I encourage people to go to Claire's website, which is claremolley.com, and that's Claire with C-L-A-R-E. And I will leave the link to that in the show notes, as well as the link to her books, all of them, not just the Second World War ones. But thank you very much again, Claire. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun being on here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Please visit me at my blog, stephenjbedard.com/Second World War. Please consider supporting this podcast by downloading a free audiobook with a free trial of Audible. And the audiobooks that I'm going to recommend are the ones by Claire Mulley. Both of her books, The Women Who Flew for Hitler and The Spy Who Loved, are available on Audible, and you can download one of them for free with a free trial from Audible. Just go to audibletrial.com/hopesreason. Again, that's audibletrial.com/hopesreason. Thanks again for listening, and God bless.